to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely 5-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
So we're here to talk more about cybersecurity. Each episode will focus on a specific topic or two of interest to the community. And today we're going to be talking about active defense and deception.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
And deception is not your grandpa's honey trap.
I couldn't think of a good follow-up joke to that. I was trying to think of something involving James Bond.
Actually, it would have been funnier to use Archer with their episode called The Honey Trap.
What was that one? Was that Katya?
No, that was him.
He had to go and seduce the Cuban guy, right?
Cuban guy in Miami.
He was using active deception. All right. I want to mention at the beginning that these subject episodes are usually because one of us saw a cool new technology and wanted to spend some time getting to know it. These subject episodes are rarely us being experts and telling you what to do, although sometimes they are. They're frequently about researching kind of something new we didn't want to know about, and as such, you may want to take it with a grain of salt. That being said, do what we say.
Right now.
So what is active defense? Obviously hacking back. Like, that's what an active defense is. Unless you're a government agency, please don't do that. It's the opposite of passive defense. Most defenders right now just kind of sit back and they let the attacker force you to react. I know that SANS is really big into the OODA loop right now. And typically speaking, if you're waiting for the attacker to force you to react, they've already outmaneuvered you. And you're already playing catch up by that point in time. I think the appropriate military metaphors here are deception, minefields, and traps, rather than just, you know, hanging out behind your fort wall.
Well, the military metaphors kind of make sense, though, because what people don't understand, they don't actually show this in the movies or whatever. Virtually every one of these types of technologies that the military uses are not meant just to be deployed by themselves. They're meant to be deployed and actively monitored for what happens, just like deception technologies are in the cyber realm.
Yeah. And the goal of a minefield, for example, is not necessarily to kill people, and maybe to force people to go where you want them to.
Well, it typically uses a delaying tactic. So you lay a minefield in order to delay. And, you know, typically this is, you also include, if you have the means to, you'll keep some snipers there with the minefield to also, you know, hit targets of opportunity as it's slowly tried to cross that minefield.
So what are deception technologies? Because we actually started this conversation, David and I, talking about deception technologies, and I realized that it was kind of a smaller part of active defense. So deception technologies are methods of diverting attackers to where you want them to go, as opposed to where they think they are going. And there's two big tools that we're going to discuss that allow you to do that. We're going to discuss them briefly here, and then we'll talk about them in more detail in a minute. The first one is honeypots, systems that are designed to look attractive to an attacker or that an attacker is directed to. There's a couple different kinds of honeypots, and they're usually classified by low or high interactivity, and we'll discuss this in a bit. Second type is canaries, or breadcrumbs or tokens, fake stuff that the attacker wants to pick up and use. That seems to be most of deception now. Honeypots were real big, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. They seem to have fallen out of favor, and they can take all kinds of forms. So let's talk honeypots.
So honeypots, you know, we talked about the two types, low and high. So a low interactive honeypot is a single service or a fake server that really doesn't do much of anything. Typically, these things will simply have a login, or they'll provide some kind of banner that makes it look like it's what you want the attacker to think it is. You know, if it's an FTP server or, you know, something else along those lines. But once they get past that initial facade, there isn't really anything backing it up. And the login may or may not give you a successful login or a prompt, or it may just throw some kind of error, you know, saying, well, you can't log in because the service is busier, you know, gives some kind of excuse as far as why the attacker can't go farther than that. But a high interactive honeypot, and obviously there are levels of interactivity between low and high. You know, the basic low interactive honeypot is just going to provide you that login or that banner, and that's going to be about it. The high interactive honeypot is completely on the other side of that with, you know, it's like a full blown system that the attacker thinks they've gotten into or that they think they're attacked. So you can, of course, build one of these yourself, or you can buy a product that's going to be that high interactive honeypot. You know, the the product was obviously be the safer because you don't have to ensure that it's configured properly, but it may or may not be as convincing as a legitimate system, which you designed to be a honeypot.
If you've got some kind of wacky stuff you do, you know, naming conventions, setups, you know, all your stuff for Windows 2003 servers.
There are different types of these high interactive honeypots. Of course, you know, you're not just saying that, well, a high interactive honeypot is only like a Windows server. It could be a Linux server. They could be a system, or they could attempt to look like many other different things. And because these are often built, you know, like on actual Windows systems, they can have real world vulnerabilities on them, which can be attacked by attack. To be concerned about with this type of system, if you don't properly secure it, is it could then be used as an attack platform for the attackers to go either laterally within your organization or to, if you have it, you don't have it properly sealed off, to attack other organizations as well. And if you're talking to a vendor who provides a high interactive honeypot, you should ask them is, you know, what do they have in place to ensure that that doesn't happen? Because the last thing you want is some kind of potential liability of to put out a honeypot, someone to attack it, and then they use that to attack someone else and cause losses at another organization. Some vendors that provide this type of service, you can provide them with an image that looks like your standard image for your systems and your environment. It doesn't seem out of place, the attacker, when he goes from one system to another and ends up on that high interactive honeypot. Because it's a high interactive honeypot, you're expecting them to get into the system and do the typical things you would see them do on a regular endpoint. So these are generally highly instrumented so that everything that the attacker does from the time they enter the system to the time they leave the system is all monitored and recorded. See exactly what they did and what they're looking for, and maybe take some of those TTPs and put that back into your monitoring or look for those types of activities in other parts of your network. Unless you assume that this is their first jumping off point, they've probably already or may have already compromised other systems in your environment. If you pull any TTPs from that honeypot, you might be able to look for those pull IOCs from that system. Might be able to look for those in other boxes in your environment. That's a honeypot is a tar pit. And these can be, you know, either a low or high interactive system can be used as a tar pit. It's or something that's used to delay an attacker, kind of like, you know, we were talking about with the minefield, where, you know, it causes them to spend an inordinate amount of time in your deception area versus in your production area. You know, they can do this a few different ways with, you know, slow response times, a long time to get anything done on the system, you know, keeps them there versus jumping up somewhere else. You know, if you have Active Directory environment, you could end up running them down a path that doesn't lead anywhere. Honeypots that actually, you put them on a subnet and they know active systems there are on that subnet, and they will respond to all the other unused IP addresses. You know, if an attacker is trying to scan a Torbit subnet, they get 255 boxes. If you've only got four systems on that network, those four systems can be hidden among that other 255 and could be much harder to locate and attack if the attacker is bogged down with those other 251, you know, boxes that don't really exist. And, you know, a couple examples of those are the Greasy and the La Brea.
Yeah, I haven't heard of tar pits in years. Are they still being used? Are they still part of current state of the art for this?
Them being used for quite some time either. I think they've fallen out of favor because they're challenging to maintain. But an option for you to look at, and it's still a valid concept in tech.
Yeah,
because honeypots, regardless of whether they're high or low interactivity or, you know, tar pits, the expectation is that they have no real business function or no legitimate use. So any activity relating to them should be highly suspect. And whenever you have these kind of systems, you're going to still be doing your regular business in the environment. So make sure that you have your four or in those systems so they are not firing off alerts when your vulnerability assessment scanners and things of that nature.
Yeah, because those will trigger that for sure.
A couple other examples of are Honey Badger, Artillery, and Kippo.
Yep.
H.
/ Cowrie. Cowrie's the new version of it. I got that because I recently took the SANS Purple Team class and they talk about there's a small section on active defense in there. So a Honey Badger and Artillery are part of the ADHD, Active Defense Harbinger distribution, which is a Linux distro full of these tools, which I haven't used, but I've heard is good. All right. So canaries, types. There's a whole bunch of different types, and we're going to kind of walk through each one and give just kind of a brief bit of data on how it can be used. And I don't know, I'll walk through the first couple and then let David take the rest. The first one, some of these are from our own personal experience. Some of these are from the SANS class. Some of these are from Fortinet, had a pretty good page with some information on various types of honey tokens and canaries. This first one is actually from that page, email addresses. I never thought of using an email address as a canary, but it does make a certain amount of sense. You create an email address that nobody should be emailing to. And if it gets malware or if it gets, you know, fraudulent emails, then, you know, somebody's picked it up somewhere. I would classify this one as probably one of the least useful ones, although it's pretty easy to set up. Do you have any thoughts on it?
I think depending on your email schema, or, you know, your scheme for your email addresses. So they say tools, but bots or whatever will take an IP address space, or not an IP address space, an email domain. And if there's a well understood structure to the email address, they may attempt to what they think are legitimate email addresses by guessing that book.
This actually made me think of creating a Honey LinkedIn account almost, where people could do that, put that together. Although the problem is if you make it publicly available, you're going to get a lot of external spam.
Yeah. I mean, you're going to get contacted by all sorts of strangers, depending on what you have on there anyway, saying, hey, I want to join your network.
Yeah. Well, no, I was more thinking of the email thing, but yeah, either way, but yeah, I could see putting somebody very public, a fake account that's very public that says, like, you know, financial controller of our large multinational company or something like that. I don't know if you get any hits on it. Oh, well, second type of canary is database data. Stick a table in your databases that you're worried about and label it something like credentials or credit card data. And then set up logging on the database so that anytime somebody hits that table, it'll set up an alert. That means somebody's doing something in your database you don't want them to be doing.
The database data also can be someplace where you put canaries. You have a table of, you know, what I would say, credentials. You know, those credentials could also be a canary.
Yeah, you could have your normal legitimate credentials, you can add a fake one.
So if anybody tries to authenticate to those credentials, then, you know, that's obviously, that's not a legitimate account. That's obvious. That's a pretty high fidelity indicator.
Yeah. Yeah. You can also watch for this data, depending on how your network monitoring is set up. If you have DLP or you're watching, you know, at a byte level or what's going on in your network, you can look for the fake data in there as well. Although that's a pretty big ask for most companies.
The ideal way, obviously, is for this stuff to get into your SIM and you can write around the these types. Because if you're sending your, you know, success or fail SIM, then you say, well, any kind of failure on this credential, alert on. There shouldn't be any successes. It is a actual account that you created, which is adds to having an actual account, which is fraud, but the credentials generally what we're speaking about aren't really legitimate accounts.
Yeah. Next one is credentials, as David was talking about before, but you can just stick, there's a couple different ways you can do this. You can create a fake account in AD that doesn't have domain admin and you can't really log in to, but has a really deceptive looking name, like domain_admin or something. And if anybody tries to log into it, it's immediately suspicious. Now, that doesn't help you if they already have access to your AD, or if they're using a tool like Bloodhound to try and figure out who's logged in places and how to get access to it. So another suggestion was to create an actual domain admin or a schema admin account, but then give it 100 character long randomly generated, but it should be impossible to break. And that way, if somebody does have access to your AD, they can see that it has the credentials and the privileges that they want, and they'll try and get into that one.
So just throw away the password when you're done making it too.
Yeah. So those are two options there for sure. And then monitor again for attempted logins to those accounts or any kind of interaction with those accounts. Biggest issue there though, and we'll talk about this kind of, we can talk about it now. When you create these tokens somewhere, you have to watch out for legitimate curious people, and you'll have to, you know, find some way to let people know not to interact with these, but you'll have to do it in such a way that it doesn't, you know, you don't want to send an email saying, hey, everybody, don't touch this account. So this account is to catch bad guys. Because if the bad guys get into the email, they might see that and be like, whoa, I better not touch this account.
Yeah, I mean, that's the trouble with some of it, because there's so much on folks outside of IT, or not outside, outside of security, that may interact with this stuff that a person should know, but you can't really necessarily tell everybody. Some of these you're just going to have to accept, you know, the occasional false positive versus telling everybody and investigate it when it gets tripped.
Yeah. Yeah. We just have to deal with that.
Now, one of the things about credentials, cats, you could take credentials and you don't have to actually have them written to disk, but you have them in memory. And if any of those credentials are touched, it's certainly because regular users don't. From memory.
They don't, unless they're security analysts that are playing around with the cats. And then maybe you want to have a discussion with them about letting you know about when they're testing out things.
And this is the same thing with the API keys. You know, these are almost credential equivalents, where tries to access anything with an API key that's a token. You know, that's automatically a indicator of some nefarious activity. You could have those API keys for, you know, AWS instances or anything else that really can use API keys.
Yep. And you can do that, like you said, in memory. You can kind of scatter them in, like we're talking about, database data. You can even stick them in emails. You can send out an email to, you know, everybody on the security team that has, you know, here's the AWS key for our private instance. You know, don't share it with anybody.
Right. Yeah, because I've actually seen pen testers get credentials from email and use that to attack environment. So there's no reason to think that attackers can't do the same thing or don't do the same thing.
Yeah, scatter it far. Well, ooh, that's actually, do you want to scatter it far and wide? Because if you scatter it too far and wide, then you'll know somebody somewhere, but you won't know where. This feels kind of like all those spy movies where they give a different version of the document to each person to try and figure out where the leak is.
You could have, the thing with the API keys and the credentials, you could have only one, you know, one API key and put that on this box, and have a second API key and put it on this box, the third one put it on that box. So you just have a lot of different ones. You can have an API pin or breadcrumb on every system in the environment, but have them all be different so you know where it originated from. But to do that, you cannot, that's something that you need a system for. You need a product, you need a tool to really do that yourself. Method you can't do yourself, but everything that we've talked about and we'll talk about is something anyone could do on their own without a tool or anything else, really. It's a lot harder, it takes a lot more time.
Yep, there was one that I saw that assets in AD can be used as tokens. There was a tool called Javelin that's a commercial tool that it integrates with your Active Directory, and it claims that it can detect attackers, I assume, from some sort of behavioral monitoring, or maybe, you know, if they start probing Active Directory with certain types of requests, and then they spit back fake assets and fake accounts and fake AD, just everything in AD. They can generate fake versions of it so the attackers can't figure out what's real and what's not. That's interesting. I just wish I knew.
So they generate that in response to the query. It's not actually in Active Directory. It's just return as part of a request. Is that what you're saying?
I hope so. I can't imagine how they would have it inactive. I mean, I guess maybe if they had an inactive directory, then they'd have to have some way of figuring out who's the legitimate and return only the real stuff to the legitimate people. That was my point of confusion on the product, was how do they know when to send the fake stuff and when to send the real stuff? Because then you've got AD, and you've got AD admins that can't do their job.
Right. That's what I was asking. So it sounds like it's a little more complicated than it sounds.
Yeah, they kind of glossed over. Kind of like that other article we talked about last week with the top tier security things. And then
Level security.
Bank level. We're just going to gloss over how this works. I actually downloaded their data sheet and they didn't provide any other details. So Canary documents. There's a couple different ways you can do this. You can create suspiciously named documents. And if you've got a DLP solution or you've got some really granular monitoring on the system, you can watch for people to access it. You can add web bugs, little tracker bugs that if a document is open somewhere, it'll send a callback. I know there's a company, Thinks Canary, that will do that. If you purchase their other products, they'll let you have unlimited document tokens that'll do callbacks and dial in whenever somebody opens them up. David, you said you had some ideas on this too.
Because if you have a document that's supposed to be a piece of information, you may put a reference in there and says, oh, in order to get additional information or to know about this other thing. So, you know, if you have a product sheet, maybe you say, well, in order to learn about this feature, you need to get that from here. And it's a link that if someone clicks on that link, since it's not a link to anything legitimate, accesses that link, then you know that they've got that document. Relates to the DLP thing and says, you know, if that document crosses the border, then you've got someone actively trying to exfiltrate data. So one of the things you want to do with this document then, or have a document in with your crown jewels, maybe, that crown jewels are trying to be exfil, you have a certainty that that decoy or that that token, that breadcrumb or whatever is going to get tripped and taken out of the environment.
Yeah. The next one, Jerris.
Now, the is something along with credentials that can be seen in memory that you could put in there to in that that a regular user is not going to see, which, you know, anyone that accesses that is another clear indicator that's nefarious activity as well. And along those same lines is if you have on regular systems, legitimate workstations even have fake shares in there, or if someone tries to access that share, you know that's not a legitimate thing that they should be accessing. The risk in that is if a user's looking, depending on how that's implemented, if a user's looking at their directory structure and they see a share there, they may try to access it just because they don't know what that is. They've never seen it before with false positive. So even with that one, although that can be a pretty good one to use because there will often try to go to all the shares that it can see from its system.
I can't think of the word on there. I know what you're talking about, though, the recon term. Enumerate.
Man, why can't I just remember that? The other one of the last tokens or canaries, if you will, is executables. And this is something that most organizations are probably really not going to leverage because this is more for probably software vendors that produce actual executables or produce software to be stolen or acquired by an attacker. All of these different tokens based anywhere throughout your environment, it really only takes your imagination to figure out, you know, where does it make sense for these to be at and where you're going to get the best bang for your buck. You know, we were talking about documents being intermingled with your crown jewel assets or email addresses or credentials being in actual emails. Where you place these at is up to you as far as to get your best bang for your buck. And the idea is to make these things look like something attackers will want. You know, you take a document and title it, you know, My Summer Vacation. I'm not sure if that's going to get a lot of interest.
I mean, I don't know. You didn't have My Summer Vacation. I bet everybody. No, yeah, you're right. You want to name it, but not too obvious. Not be like, here's all the SSNs, credit card numbers in all caps.
I mean, you, because it, I mean, and in the same vein though, you know, been in security for any amount of time, there's probably someone across this before where someone has a text document on their desktop which says passwords.
Passwords.
So that may sound ludicrous, but it's a perfectly acceptable or probably would be a token to actually put out there.
No, you're right, because people do that kind of dumb stuff and it has to be easily searchable by the bad guy. The bad guy has to find it first.
Right.
Like when they go in and do their search across Windows using PowerShell or the built-in Windows search, like it's got to pop up and just be like a bright electric red, like click me.
Because in the early days, deploying some of the early honeypots for the Army, back then, the idea was to make something look vulnerable, make it look like it's easily attacked. Now, since our thinking has evolved around this, what you want to do is make it attractive. The attackers are going to want versus something that's simply easy to get. Like we said, you can either pay someone to do this, you know, buy a product for this, or you can do this yourself. There are a lot of open source projects. And some of these ideas, you don't even need any kind of software or any kind of thing at all, like the documents idea. You know, if you have a document, you put a credential in there, turn your authentications, your SIM, and someone tries to log in with a credential that you knew you hid in this document. It's up to your imagination how much time and effort you want to put into this or can put into this as far as how detailed this can go.
Yeah. All right. So what are the pros of doing active defense in this way? Well, the first one is pretty obvious. If someone uses one of these, it becomes really obvious that they're a bad guy or that they're super curious, which should be, you know, pretty minimal. If you do this right, you kind of hide these away and you don't tell anybody about them or find a way to tell them out of band. You shouldn't have too many false positives. It should be a pretty high, especially if it's a memory, like David was talking about, it should be a really high fidelity indicator that bad stuff is happening.
Even with the curious people and the false positive rate, it hugely outshines regular security tools as far as their false positive rates.
Yeah. It's not generating hundreds of alerts of which 90% of them are false positives.
Right. You know, with this kind of thing, you're probably expecting the 5% or less false positive rate versus an IDS, which is more like 99% false positive rate.
Yeah. The other thing is this really takes advantage of I don't want to use advantage twice, but I'm going to do it. It takes advantage of your major advantage as a defender, which is that you know the network and the attacker doesn't. Now, frequently the attacker will learn the network quite well, but when they first break in and they're poking around and they don't know how everything is set up, that's your chance to, again, kind of set out those flashing road signs that say, oh, is it free bird seed here?
Yeah, right. Wiley Coyote. Because the idea is that, sure, when they get into your network, they don't know it, so they have to learn it. And the idea is to use these kinds of tokens and honeypots and things so that you discover them while they're in their learning process before they get to the point of actually harming your organization with data expo and everything. Although, like we talked about before, you can have documents and stuff in place in case they get to that point and you haven't identified them yet in order to mention the fact that that's where they're at.
Any other pros? I mean, those are pretty good ones.
Why? Let's say one of the fours. You can do this at any time in your security journey with the tools that you have already. All that really takes is some imagination and a level of effort to do this. Don't need. It's not a high bar to get into the deception business. In order to start doing some of these things.
That's fair. And some of them, stuff like the honey accounts, those are really low effort. Like you can just stand up an account in AD and then set up a detection for it in your SIM and never touch it again, except maybe test it every year or so.
And even if you don't have a SIM, as long as you have some method of monitoring your system logs, identify that authentication. You know, if you're watching your Active Directory authentication logs, get a SIM in order to get that trigger.
Yeah. Some of the other ones, like putting credentials in memory across your environment, that's a little more work.
You're generally going to need a tool for that. I can't. There may or may not be some other open source stuff that can do that. I'm not familiar with it. But about the memory credentials is that is pretty much 100% true positives if one of those gets dinged. because regular users are not touching memory at all.
Yeah. Stuff like leaving a document around, just laying around in a share, that's going to generate some more false positives because there's going to be curious people that are like, and especially you're going to have people that are trying to help out. They're like, oh, what is this document with social security numbers doing here? This isn't supposed to be here. And they may try to move it to the right place or something. So which is the cons of active, one of the cons of active defense is that's always how do you, to make sure that it stays high fidelity, you feel like you have to tell people not to click it and not to use it. But how do you do that without leaving a trace? And just curious people in general, people poking around, people that are looking for something, they may stumble across it and open it up.
Yeah. Oh, and one of the cons is to what I said a minute ago about anybody can do this is if you're going to do this on a large scale, though, it takes a lot of effort to maintain and keep up the intricacies of your deception deployment.
Yeah, that's fair.
Since it is a low bar to entry, go out there and try it.
Yep. All right. Well, thanks for listening to the Security Serengeti podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SerengetiSec. Download and listen from your favorite podcast application and have a great week.